Hi, everybody. Welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. This is Nancy Bernatitis, and I'm your moderator this evening. Tonight, we're talking with Karen Haynes, who's going to be sharing some information about seizures with us. She's the author of Silently Seizing. I'm going to read your her bio to you as soon as I find it here. I've got too many pictures up on my computer. Karen Haynes is the mother of a 24-year-old son diagnosed with autism as a young child. As a registered nurse, Karen relies upon her nurse's training to assist her in deciphering the origins of many of her son's perplexing behaviors. Based on knowledge gained from years of intensive research she compiled for this book, as well as information provided by top researchers in the field of autism, Karen is helping families become free from the debilitating symptoms of silent seizures and psychosis. She is also co-author of a children's book, Georgie, The Flying Dog, which explores the concept of unconditional love and acceptance of our differences. Welcome, Karen.
Well, thank you so much, and welcome everybody to my presentation about the hidden connection between autism and partial seizure disorders. I have written a book entitled Silently Seizing, Common, Unrecognized, and Frequently Missed Seizures and Their Potentially Damaging Effect on Individuals with Autism Spectrum Disorders. My book chronicles my personal experience with autism and partial seizure, and it is due to be released in a few weeks from Autism Asperger Publishing Company. The book can be ordered now through the publisher's website in advance of the release date of September 5th. During my presentation this evening, I will be explaining what I have learned on my journey about autism in general and the relationship between autism and seizure, as well as reading certain chosen passages from my book. I am going to begin by reading to you the introduction to my book, which provides an overview of our discussion here tonight. Thank you all for coming, and I hope to aspire to leave you with something worthwhile to take with you on your journey. I just want to say that I have a little bit of a cold, so forgive me if I have to pause periodically and take a drink. Okay, here's the introduction. A world turned upside down. I felt motivated to write this book based upon my experience as a mother on the front lines of autism for more than 20 years. In my estimation, and with the agreement of some expert physicians, my beautiful son likely suffers with difficult-to-recognize partial seizures along with his autism diagnosis. On this journey, I have gathered information that might improve the outcome for the estimated 50 children who are being diagnosed with autism every single day. I hope this information finds its way into the hands of all parents facing an autism diagnosis in their child, especially those with a recent diagnosis who can benefit the most from the help. My son Josh was diagnosed at 2 years, 10 months old with autism, and all of his odd behaviors were deemed just a part of this perplexing condition. Many of Josh's abnormal behaviors, such as screaming, pulling his hair out, staring cells, and speaking gibberish, were misinterpreted as the self-stimulatory behavior typical of autism. Based on this diagnosis, my family was supposed to grieve the loss of the normal child we would never have, accept it, and move on. Could epilepsy be contributing to his diagnosis of autism? What we now know, but did not know then, is that these behaviors can also be signs of partial epilepsy, a seizure disorder that can be very difficult to recognize and is often easily misdiagnosed. Many people miss the more subtle signs seen in this condition and therefore also miss the opportunity for early diagnosis and treatment, which is crucial to ensure the best possible outcome. My intention in writing this book was to let parents know that many of the troubling behaviors they're witnessing in their children are generally categorized by the medical community as symptomatic of autism, but they may also be caused by stealth, absence, or partial seizures, which are easily treated. An absence seizure can produce a blank stare, involuntary movements, chewing movements of the mouth, and may only last a few seconds. A partial seizure may begin with jerking of one area of the body, arm or leg, often while the patient is awake and aware. A more complex version, called complex partial seizure, starts with a blank stare, followed by chewing movements of the mouth. The person can mumble gibberish and seem like they are in a trance. This kind of seizure can produce aggression. Once these seizures are treated, the brain can function more effectively, and the patient can function at a much higher level. Many of the behaviors the seizure produces will subside with treatment. Untreated, these seizures can bring brain damage, which can lead to serious harmful effects such as self-injury and psychosis later in life. Therefore, the seizures must be recognized and treated early to preserve the function of the developing brain. If your child is older and has become self-injurious or psychotic, it's not too late for intervention. A protocol of medicine described in this book has worked well for my son and other children so effectively that the episodes were almost completely extinguished. Some children are getting treated early and actually losing the diagnosis of autism altogether. It is my greatest wish that other parents of children with autism will find this book and be spared some of the suffering and confusion that we and our precious children have had to endure. I hope my experience will inspire parents to do their own research and educate themselves thoroughly about their children's diagnoses, rather than to just accept what is told to them. It is important to dissect and analyze the child's behaviors so they can be accurately described to the doctor and diagnosed as seizure-related. If an unrecognized seizure disorder is the underlying issue that is causing the constellation of symptoms that we call autistic, then treating it could produce a miracle of healing. Josh's story. Josh's early childhood seemed normal because initially he had developed language and was engaging meaningfully with us using good eye contact and appropriate play. But between 18 months and 2 years, the few coveted words he had acquired, stop, up, ball, and juice, were seemingly uttered less and less frequently. I began to become painfully aware that Josh seemed to be slipping away. He was becoming distant and quiet. It was as though a water faucet was being turned off in painstakingly slow motion. The person inside of him was beginning to fade. Instead of language flowing out of him, language appeared to be flowing away from him. I also began to notice that for seconds at a time, my beautiful toddler would suddenly stare off in a distant, hypnotic gaze. For the duration of the brief spell, nothing I said or did could penetrate his gaze or divert his attention. I began to wonder if he had a partial form of epilepsy because I became familiar with partial seizures in nursing school. But at the time, I was counseled by our pediatrician to begin to look for the more obvious kinds of problems first. Our doctor suggested that we see an audiologist to see if our son had any type of hearing loss. This was the first step we took in an attempt to diagnose and evaluate what might be underlying our son's abnormal development. Our first stop at the audiologist was our attempt to discover if maybe Josh was losing or lost his hearing. The audiologist asked for the developmental history, and then she offered the standard testing. The audiologist escorted an unwilling Josh into a soundproofed room and then into a big black chair, and she proceeded to place an enormous pair of black headphones upon his tiny head. As they piped in all kinds of sounds, he would hopefully hear beeps on one side and then the other. She began, and immediately I could see that Josh became upset by the sporadic arrangement of sounds. It quickly became evident to us that he was terribly annoyed by all of these noises. By the end of the session, we felt confident and thankful in making the conclusion that Josh was not suffering with a new onset hearing loss. Our next stop on the journey of discovery was to have Josh evaluated by a speech and language pathologist. She proceeded to do a litany of testing without me in the room, despite Josh's protest. I remember that Josh had a very hard time separating from me. When Josh emerged from the testing, which lasted for over an hour, he looked sleepy, and he was clutching his little soft blanket along with a new label, speech delay of 1 year. Oddly enough, I recall feeling that the diagnosis did not seem that scary, as I remember feeling as if I could deal with it. This audiologist suggested ways in which we could try and augment Josh's understanding of language by using pictures with words, and she also suggested strongly we begin to become familiar with the technique of applied behavior analysis, commonly referred to as ABA. I had no idea what ABA was, but before long, I would become very familiar with it. I was still very worried about Josh's staring spells, which, as they progressed, they happened 50 times in a given day, each episode lasting for mere seconds, and yet they were very noticeable. The next step on the journey of discovery was to take Josh to a neurologist as he was approaching his third birthday. Dr. Ingrid Taff, a well-respected neurologist in Great Neck, New York, did an evaluation with Josh and afterwards became concerned with the possibility that Josh could have petite mal epilepsy, also called absent seizure. These seizures are caused by an electrical misfiring deep inside the brain's temporal lobe, where much of language originates. She performed a standard test for epilepsy, called an electroencephalogram, commonly called an EEG. This test measures and records the electrical activity of the brain through electrodes that are attached to the outside of the skull and hooked up to a monitor. The computer monitor records the brain's electrical activity. The test was performed with a bit of sedation to ensure my son's cooperation, and the result was considered to be normal. Based upon my observations of the numerous staring spells, which coincided with a noticeable loss of language, his doctor suspected that Josh had these absent seizures. And it's interesting to note that children with absent seizures have high rates of behavioral, emotional, and social problems, which are the exact same problems seen in autism. Dr. Taff shared with us that she believed once Josh was stable on a proper dose of the anti-seizure drug, he would begin to speak and begin to learn. Josh was prescribed Tegretol to control the suspected absent seizures, even though his EEG was read as normal. Unfortunately, within 24 hours of taking the first dose, Josh developed a head-to-toe welt-like rash, and he was immediately taken off the medication. Coincidentally, the following day, we had a long-awaited appointment with a neuropsychiatrist who, we were told, was the expert on pervasive developmental disorders. After the initial intake chat, this doctor brought Josh into a room that had all sorts of toys. He began to attempt to engage Josh in play activities in order to assess his developmental level. The doctor tried to interact with Josh for close to an hour. While together, they were sorting objects, pretending to cook in a make-believe kitchen, and playing games which test one's memory. Josh seemed engaged at times, but he also seemed for the most part to be out of it that day, and I began to feel uncomfortable as I watched the scene unfolding. As I watched Josh with what I thought was a measure of objectivity, I surmised that he must be tired, a bit cranky from the terribly itchy rash, and maybe today of all days, he was feeling a tad stubborn. But the doctor had a very different take on it. At the end of his assessment, he looked very concerned. He escorted us into his office where he asked us to sit down. It was then that he told us simply and clearly, "Your son Josh has autism. That day will be forever etched in my memory. I will never ever forget the way he looked at us." He had a very serious, stern look on his face as he delivered the bad news. He was certain, and then there was no room for doubt or pleading. I remember as I looked at him, I could barely see his face through my cascading tears. As they fell in torrents on my shirt, I looked over at my then-husband, who was looking severely pained. The diagnosis was searing in its honesty. We accepted the diagnosis without question, placing blind faith in his knowledge, and began the descent into the grief and pain that this realization brings. We listened carefully to his assessment, and without much deliberation, we decided he must be right. After all, he is a self-proclaimed expert on pervasive developmental disorders. We told him about Dr. Taft's assessment of partial seizure, but he felt the spells were all a part of the condition known as autism, not a separate or treatable entity. He did not encourage us to continue on the seizure path by trying another medication. And based upon the neuropsychiatrist's minimal assessment, he concluded Josh has autism. And tragically, we believed him. The doctor went on to say to us, most of these children have a lifelong developmental delay and have great difficulty adjusting socially. Most children with autism have mental intellectual impairment, and only 20% have normal or above average intelligence. He felt Josh had varying degrees of cognitive ability, with memory being one of his strengths. This doctor said that these staring spells were likely an integral part of Josh's autism rather than a separate or treatable entity. So sadly, we took his advice, discarding the idea of treating Josh's invisible seizures. In hindsight, I am certain that this decision was a tragic mistake. Many years later, as I began to put the puzzle pieces together, I realized that Josh had a seizure disorder all along. And as it progressed, its manifestations went well beyond staring spells. Josh's most severe seizures produced a vicious rage, undirected horrific violence, and self-mutilating behavior, including bites that have left his skin forever scarred. Knowing what I know now, I agonize over a wish that I could somehow go back in time and change the choices that I made. I had two roads presented to me, and I chose the wrong one. Seizures can damage the brain, and I'm going to tell you why I think so. My intention in writing this book is to alert parents and help them understand that the many troubling behaviors they're witnessing in their children are generally categorized by the medical community as symptomatic of autism, but they may be caused by hidden stealth seizures, which are easily treated. Often, many of the bizarre behaviors and language impairments disappear completely. Left untreated, these seizures can cause brain damage in the form of psychosis and the associated self-injury. Dr. Richard Restack, a clinical professor of neurology at George Washington University and the author of many books on the brain, wrote an article about complex partial seizures and their association with psychosis. Dr. Restack makes an important point, which is when seizures begin to come under control with anti-seizure medication, a deterioration in the neuropsychiatric status is seen. Schizophrenic-like epileptic psychosis often emerges when the anticonvulsants are normalizing or improving the seizures. Both issues need to be treated separately for a remission, and if the psychosis is not treated, it soon becomes more of a problem than the seizures. Dr. Restack's paper, entitled Complex Partial Seizures Presents a Diagnostic Challenge, is a must-read for anyone looking to understand the complexities of treating temporal lobe epilepsy. It is interesting to note that many years ago, autism was called childhood schizophrenia, and maybe the discovery of the association between seizure and psychosis sheds light upon that thesis. it is never too late for intervention, because at whatever point the appropriate intervention is applied, the brain, this miraculous organ, will attempt to heal itself by creating new neural pathways. This process is known as plasticity of the brain. Why didn't the doctors want to believe that Josh could be suffering from an underlying syndrome of silent seizure? Why were they so willing to discard Dr. Taft's earlier assessment of a seizure disorder? Was it simply the lack of clinical proof causing a complete disregard of what seemed to be so obvious? We now know that the results of many of the conventional tests currently used to detect seizures can often be completely normal, despite a true diagnosis of epilepsy. Many experts now agree that the diagnosis of a partial seizure disorder has to be made clinically. That means based upon a description of the person's symptoms and the patterns in which they occur. This is precisely how Dr. Taft had diagnosed Josh years earlier. It was my observation and the description of the staring spells that prompted her to begin treatment with anti-seizure medication. And that is why it is so important that parents and caretakers of children with autism arm themselves with as much knowledge as they can possibly glean from those who have made an in-depth study of this perplexing disorder. My book goes into great detail about the various types of seizures and how to recognize them. I also detail the psychosis, which can be a part of the seizure itself, or it can manifest in acute, sudden attacks, but this needs to also be treated. I had to learn this by researching on my own, day and night. The authority I had come to rely upon was not giving me the answers I needed to help my son. It is so important to work with a team of experts who have the background to understand and treat the complexities of this disorder. Most importantly, trust your instincts if you feel you are being disregarded. You know your child better than any doctor evaluating him or her for a brief snapshot in time. The information in this book will help you communicate more effectively with your doctor, and if you still feel disregarded, it might be time for another opinion. So often, we all rely on inexact science to tell us what's wrong with our children without ever questioning that science. And this can lead, sometimes, to the erroneous assumptions that we all make as to why a child lashes out, screams, becomes violent. But the truth is, we don't always know the answer. The reason we don't always know the answer is because many of these children cannot answer the basic question, what's wrong? So we are left to explain it somehow, relying on supposition. It makes no sense for adverse behavior to arise out of the blue without provocation, and yet many feel entitled to decide the basis for it. We are told our children are light-gazing, a supposed form of self-stimulatory behavior, when often they are simply staring due to a seizure. This chronic misunderstanding of these behaviors leads to misdiagnosis, and it is having tragic consequences for this vulnerable population. We must put an end to it and help our loved ones to be understood. Now, I wanted to read from my chapter 2 a little bit about what autism is and what it is not. Most of us are aware of the dramatic rise in the diagnosis of autism over the past 10 to 15 years. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, also known as the CDC, reported in 2010 that autism spectrum disorders affect an average of 1 in 110 children in the U.S. In 2012, the measure has increased to 1 in 88. Is the incidence of autism actually increasing in our population, or is it just being recognized and diagnosed more frequently than in the past? If the increase is real, then what is causing it? Is it the additives that were once put into our childhood vaccines, which has since been deemed toxic and removed? Could it be that toxic chemicals have found their way into our food and our water? Is it a proliferation of genetic mutations, some of them not yet detectable by conventional testing methods? Speculation abounds regarding these questions and has been a subject of heated debate. One particularly controversial theory suggests that autism may be created in vulnerable people through exposure to a mercury compound called thimerosal, formerly used as a preservative in childhood vaccines. This supposed link between autism and vaccination was fueled by simple but inconclusive observation. First of all, many children develop symptoms of autism during the same period of time that they received the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. Second, mercury is a known toxic compound that can result in neurological damage in children and adults that appears symptomatically similar to autism. Despite the compelling simplicity of the alleged connection between autism and thimerosal, the available research suggests that there is no reliable relationship between them at all. I believe there are many sides to the autism story that have not been fully explored. And in this chapter, I briefly go into what I believe the true origins of autism are, what it is and what it is not. The number of reported cases of autism has increased dramatically, as we know. This increase is largely attributable to changes in diagnostic practices, referral patterns, and availability of services, age of diagnosis, and public awareness, though unidentified environmental factors cannot be completely ruled out. In addition, a much bigger blanket has been cast over behavioral patterns that can be diagnosed as autism. Physicians rely on a manual known as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, also called DSM, for the criteria that spell out how a mental disorder can be classified. Autism first made its appearance in DSM in 1980. And meanwhile, in 1990, the Individuals with Disabilities Act was introduced, mandating that children with autism receive special education services in the public school. This mandate resulted in a jump in the number of cases of diagnoses labeled autism. In the Autism Epidemic Fact or Artifact article written by psychiatrist Wanza and her colleagues Bresnan and Klein, all from the Department of Epidemiology at the Mellman School of Public Health at Columbia University, point out that the average age of a child diagnosed with autism has gradually gotten younger, from about 7 years old in 1987 to 3 years old in 1994, thus creating a large jump in the overall number of cases. With the rules of the game continually changing, determining the true prevalence of autism, the number of cases in a specific population, is akin to trying to hit a moving target. But even statistical manipulation does not appear to fully explain the rising diagnostic rate. Characteristics of autism. The technical definition of autism disorder is a biologically based developmental disorder that is highly heritable. Autism affects each person in a different manner, but generally it is characterized by impairments in social interaction, impairments in communication, and restricted interest and repetitive behavior. Autism is 4 times more prevalent in boys than girls. Autism often appears initially as a noticeable language delay, which can be both spoken and comprehended language, and for some children, a loss of previously acquired skills. Many parents report that early in their child's development, they became concerned when the child fixated on objects, avoided eye contact, and engaged in hand flapping or other repetitive movements. Simple developmental stages such as picking up language from the environment, imitating behavior, or playing reciprocally can be delayed or absent. It can be difficult to assess a child's cognitive ability because language impairments make it difficult, if not impossible, to accurately ascertain what he or she truly comprehends, especially in the absence of language or in the presence of silent seizures. Many children with autism exhibit a need for rigid routine and exhibit ritualistic behavior and sensory disturbances. These children usually make little or no eye contact. Some children cry more often than typically developing children, stiffen when held, and appear quite happy to be left alone. Others exhibit communication problems such as echolalia, which is repeating what was just said to them, and pronoun reversal. For example, a child referring to himself as he or you. Behavioral disturbances can be seen at all stages of development, and in some instances, they can be quite severe and extremely violent. Children may injure themselves and others, display obsessive-compulsive type behavior, impulsiveness, mood swings, and agitation. In some children, aggression and rage may manifest suddenly, often escalating during puberty. Some speculate that hormonal changes are behind the exacerbation of aggression seen at that time. Areas of strength, such as memory, are often found in autism. For example, an estimated 0.5% to 10% of individuals with autism spectrum disorders show unusual abilities ranging from splinter skills, such as memorization of trivia, to the extraordinary rare talents of prodigious savants. Many children with autism have average to above average intelligence and are very capable of learning, participating in community life, working, and attending school, although they sometimes may need supportive services. In the highest functioning form of autism, such as Asperger syndrome, a person may have superior intelligence and even genius. Others have a more obvious intellectual disability and may grow into adults who will need support and supervision. The history of autism goes back as far as 1910 when Eugene Buehler, a Swiss psychiatrist, first coined the term. In 1943, Dr. Leo Kanner of Johns Hopkins University described early infantile autism for the first time, and he based his discovery on 11 children he observed between 1938 and 1943 who demonstrated striking behavioral similarities. Dr. Kanner coined the phrase refrigerator mothers, referring to mothers who did not provide adequate emotional attention to describe an apparent coldness he observed in many mothers of autistic children. He believed that the source of autism was innate in the affected child, but that an unemotional parent exacerbated the problem. Almost all of the characteristics described in Kanner's first paper on the subject, notably autistic aloneness and insistence on sameness, are regarded as typical of autism spectrum disorders. During the 1940s and the 1960s, the medical community felt that children who had autism were schizophrenic, psychotic, or out of touch with reality. A school of thought advanced by Bruno Bettelheim, MD, a widely known self-promoting professor of child development, in the 1940s through the 1970s, revived the term refrigerator mothers, indicating parents did not provide adequate emotional nurturing, and even comparing parents to guards in Nazi concentration camps. The theory has since been completely disregarded. Currently, a new school of thought exists in the support of a diathesis stress mode of causation. This is a theory which suggests that it takes two events to bring about an illness. Initially, a genetic vulnerability, which enhances susceptibility. And next, a stressful event or events tied to the environment, which acts as catalyst. Is autism a catch-all diagnosis? Perhaps the spectrum of behaviors and disturbances that we call autism is not a single disorder, but a series of behaviors and challenges that have many different underlying conditions, but share some common attributes, such as seizure and disturbances in language, socialization, and responses to the environment. There is no one single genetic or cognitive cause for the diverse symptoms that define autism. Studies of twins diagnosed with autism suggest that it is potentially a genetically based disorder. Thus, there is an 80 to 90% chance that both identical twins will have autism if one of them does. The fraternal twin of an affected sibling has a 3 to 10% chance of developing autism. By comparison, the chance that typical siblings will both be affected is in the range of 3 to 10%. Further, chromosomal defects such as Rett syndrome and Fragile X, described in more detail in my book, and a genetic enzyme deficiency called PKU greatly increase the chance a child will be diagnosed with autism. At the same time, there is mounting evidence to suggest that genetic mutations, which are permanent changes that damage our DNA, are at the root cause of many cases of autism. Thus, many genetic diseases greatly increase the chance that a child will develop features similar to autism, since they produce very similar traits. In 2011, a common genetic cause of epilepsy and autism was discovered. The research team, led by neurologist Dr. Patrick Cosette, found a severe mutation, which is a change in DNA, which is our hereditary material of life, on the SYN1 gene in a family suffering from epilepsy, including individuals who also had autism. For the first time, these results show that the role of the SYN1 gene occurs in autism and epilepsy, and thus strengthens the hypothesis that a dysregulation of the function of the synapse or nerve cell due to the severe genetic mutation is the cause of both diseases. A synapse is a structure that permits a nerve cell to pass an electrical signal to another cell. Due to the damage of this gene, the synapse cannot function properly, leading to an impairment of the organ function, which in this case is the brain. Trying to find hidden mini seizures is akin to trying to find a needle in a haystack. This fact has not deterred me or the wonderful doctors who contributed to my book. Dr. Nancy Minshew is an internationally recognized autism expert and the director of the Center for Excellence in Autism Research at the University of Pittsburgh. She provided incredibly valuable input for my book, Silently Seizing. She is a true pioneer in the mission to help us understand the silent seizure connection and to teach us how to dissect behavior so that we can help our children to become understood. Excuse me, I'm just going to take a drink. She explains that some seizures originate so deep in the brain's temporal lobe that the electricity they generate is simply not measurable by the standard EEG method currently employed. Dr. Minshew acknowledges that even when the discharges can be measured, the electrical storm may not be occurring while the test is being performed. She states, quote, "A person could have many EEGs with normal results and still harbor an undetected seizure disorder," close quote. Therefore, it is vital and imperative that these silent seizures, in the absence of EEG confirmation, should be diagnosed based upon astute observation of behaviors and the pattern in which they occur. Often seizures occur the same way each time. Keeping a log of each episode to see if a pattern exists is very helpful. You will have to trust your instincts and your observations and never give up on finding a doctor who understands this complicated issue. It takes tremendous perseverance on the part of caregivers. If a seizure disorder is suspected, a trial of anticonvulsant medication should be tried to see if they subside. On my journey, I met a lovely woman who contacted me about her son through my website. She suspected her son was having silent seizures. Her name is Tricia Polchowski. She is a behavior analyst and a behavior consultant. She tracked her son's seizures using techniques which I am going to describe. She believes that there are a number of ways to go about making direct observation of your child's behavior and keeping a log of these observations. She feels you need to identify a specific body movement during the episode and write it down, such as movements of a limb, which side of the body it's happening on, was it the upper or lower limbs, were there vocalizations, skin changes, changes in alertness, chewing motions of the mouth, did the patient's eyes deviate to one side or the other or roll back? All these things are vital to track, and you can do so in a diary or log. It is important to keep track of identifiers, which are the attributes of the behavior you are witnessing, and be able to tease out the behavior of the person. Such as, were there clumsy movements, staring spells, obviously temporary changes in the person's functioning? Was there a change in the intensity of the behavior, and was it out of character for that individual? If you know the behavior is typical for a person, what is their typical response to redirection? And are they deviating from that normal response? Can the person respond to verbal or written communication? If you have had success in the past with interventions, i.e. redirecting, using token economy or a reward system, and it's not working now, that would be a clue that something else is contributing. She tells us about the ABC analysis, which is defined as the antecedent, behavior, and consequence. An antecedent is what happens immediately prior to the onset of a behavior. Was the person asking to do something undesirable, or was the behavior completely out of the blue? Behavior must be specifically defined, such as how a person behaves during normal functioning and how the behavior deviates from that normal functioning. Consequence is what happens just after. Did the behavior suddenly stop? Did they recall it? And were they sleepy afterwards? Now, Trish points out that there are four reasons why people engage in behavior. Attention seeking, and that is trying to gain someone's attention. Avoidance, trying to avoid an unpleasant task. Tangible, which is to gain access to something desired, such as a preferred activity or food. And automatic reinforcement, which is something internally driven, because perhaps it produces a desired feeling. If you can determine the antecedent and the person responds to the consequence, it may be behavior-driven. But on the other hand, if no connections are found, the behavior may indeed have a medical basis. The purpose of keeping this data collection is to determine if there is a connection to any of those four reasons why someone engages in behavior. Often the behavior seen in autism can be tied to one of those four functions. And if there is no connection to one of those four functions, it might indicate a medical or seizure event. Counting the frequency of specifically identified behavior and identifying the student's concerning behavior is important, and to define exactly what it looks like so that anyone taking the data is aware of the exact nature of the behavior. It's also important to determine a span of time that the data collection will proceed and record all the episodes and in what context they occurred. For example, if a student hits the table every single day before going to music class, it may be that the music is bothering him, If he bangs the table out of the blue, in gym, at lunch, when he is seemingly happy or content, that's a clue that something else is causing the behavior. A scatter plot or graph can help to determine if there is a pattern. We know that seizures happen almost the same way each and every time, though they will happen at random times throughout a day. If it happens that a student has behavioral outbursts every day at 11 a.m. just prior to lunch, it could be that they are very hungry. If the behavior is random and the graph shows that the behavior cannot be tied to an ongoing event, it may be a subclinical seizure. Tricia Polchowski was able to track her son John's seizures using these techniques, which has led to successful recognition of his underlying seizure disorder and successful treatment of his seizures. Thank you so much, Tricia, for providing us with this essential information, which I could email to anyone who wants to have it as a reference. Knowledge is power. How many of us really have the tools we need to dissect the behavior of our autistic children? When we are told by the experts, this is just the way they are, we believe it, because we, as parents and average people, don't have the tools to look further. So we grieve a loss and go on with our lives, accepting without question that our children bang their heads for no reason, walk on their toes, cling to a wall in fear, cover their ears, stare into space, episodically scream, hit, and self-injure. We believe that this is just a part of autism, a disorder for which no existing remedy can significantly alter the course. While I did know when Josh was young that there was a lot of evidence that he was having absent seizures and had it confirmed by one expert physician, I allowed some of his doctors to insist that his behaviors were just consistent with his diagnosis of autism and simply accepted this as fact. In my pursuit to help him, extensive research became my salvation. The information to help solve part of the autism puzzle is easy to find, and yet the seizure connection is still so hotly debated and seemingly swept under the rug. I believe that some people have an irrational fear of a seizure diagnosis and thus look for any other plausible explanation. Seizures and the association with autism, coupled with the odd behavior that seizures produce, continues to be overlooked. The association of seizure and psychosis continues to be overlooked. If we as parents arm ourselves with knowledge and go on to share what we have learned with others, I know that many children and their families will greatly benefit. While I had been warned, some professionals told me that my son's behavior would become much worse at puberty, I was not at all prepared for what was coming. Since conventional testing did not register any signs of seizures, Josh's doctor suggested that he most likely would suffer now from a mood disorder with psychotic features. Josh was then treated with very high doses of an antipsychotic drug, which was supposed to help relieve the mood disorder. He was snowed under by the medication, gained an enormous amount of weight, and was drooling. A mood disorder with psychotic features as a primary diagnosis made absolutely no sense to me. Excuse me. And I immediately questioned the diagnosis in my own mind. I knew that the majority of the time, Josh was capable of being happy, gregarious, and loving. He had episodic rage attacks for no reason at all. Temporal lobe epilepsy can be distinguished from a schizophrenic patient by the maintenance, when not acutely ill, of a warm affect and good rapport. This knowledge, gleaned from years of researching, was just another tip that helped me continue to look for answers beyond a mood disorder with psychotic features. Chronic misdiagnosis of the underlying condition seen in autism is a widespread epidemic. Many times this leads to ineffective and even inappropriate treatment. Dr. Stephen M. Edelson wrote a paper entitled Autism, Puberty, and the Possibility of Seizures. In his paper, he details the symptoms of a subclinical seizure disorder. Subclinical meaning cannot be identified within a clinical setting. He goes on to say that severe tantruming, aggression, self-injury, and losing cognitive gains attained earlier in life likely are from a seizure disorder. Edelson agrees that often these seizures fail to be recognized as such, and as a result, lead to deleterious effects. I'm going to read to you an excerpt from my book and take you inside an episode of Seizure and Psychosis that accompanies it. Josh has been on his bed watching TV, his favorite show, Simpsons. Suddenly, he calls out profanity and rudely asks someone, a hallucinated entity, to leave him the F alone. It is starting, and I run, trying to negotiate the stairs two at a time so I can try to get there before he succumbs to keep him from hurting himself. His body is shaking, his pupils enlarge, and his shrill scream fills the air. His eyes glazed over as if possessed by a demon. My eyes aren't working. My eyes aren't working, Mom, he screams. And then the staring stops. No movement for 10 to 15 seconds. His eyes are widened as he's transported to a faraway place. My brain is broken, he screams, and he repeatedly taps his head. Then his fear turns a dark corner, and he becomes enraged. He lunges at me, and in a split second, his hands are suddenly around my neck. I try to extricate myself from his grip as his anger intensifies. In the seconds that follow, he throws a punch with such force that it hurls me backward onto the floor. I clutch my face in pain and disbelief. My blood is everywhere. The ninjas have guns, he growls. He begins to kick into the air while making combat-type sounds. After a few excruciating moments, the ninjas begin to retreat. He's panting and seems to settle down. He looks at the devastating scene of smashed objects, blood, and broken glass. He sees me holding my face and sobbing. He surveys the mess with profound confusion and sadness and asks me, "What happened, Mom?" He has some realization that he's responsible. Just then, my precious 18-year-old son apologizes and says, "I'm so very sorry, Mom. Can I give you a hug?" I was reluctant at that moment out of fear, so I sheepishly refused. He began to sob with his head in his hands, and he pleaded with me, "Mom, please fix my brain." Possible signs of a seizure. Sudden changes in behavior with complete cessation of the previous activity. Sudden eruption of fear, which can manifest as screaming or speaking gibberish. Enlarging pupils. The center portion of the eye, called the pupil, becomes much larger than normal, and the eyes may gaze to one side or roll up. Staring. A fixed stare and a loss of awareness with surroundings, which look like daydreaming or a trance-like state. Inability to make and understand language and use it appropriately. Sometimes they make clicking sounds with their tongue. Sometimes they have temper tantrums, which are characterized by screaming, pulling their hair out, fighting, kicking, biting, and seem to be fighting something off that we cannot see. Self-injury, which is characterized by head banging, biting, punching oneself, slapping oneself in the head. Eye blinking, facial grimacing, odd movements can be seen. Hallucinations are seeing things that are not there, called visual hallucinations. They may include ninjas, God, sometimes incredibly beautiful scenes, and sometimes one-eyed monsters or gargoyles, my son would tell me he sneaked. Auditory hallucinations characterized by hearing voices or sounds, which could account for why so many children cover their ears. Sensory hallucinations, such as smelling something that's not there, such as a burning smell. My son would complain of a burning smell. And sometimes they have an odd feeling, described as a funny sensation in the stomach. Aggression. Aggression is usually directed to whoever is closest in proximity or at oneself. Clenching of the teeth and biting down hard on their skin is frequently seen and has been called self-injurious behavior in the context of autism. In a conversation with a seasoned person, a caregiver might ask a question that goes unanswered and then look to the individual and see that they can stare. Or the person's verbal response may be incoherent and completely out of character. The events surrounding a seizure are unlike any other type of behavior. Sometimes the event is misconstrued as someone just being lost in thought. People who are lost in thought can be interrupted and can respond normally, and a seizing person cannot do either in the midst of a seizure. After a seizure, there's often a confusion period lasting minutes where the person asks what happened and seems confused. They may seem perplexed by the explanation of the caregiver since they will likely have no recall of the seizure or the events which follow. The seizure can produce a sudden attack of sleepiness and intense fatigue. Beware of this complaint, especially if the child has outgrown napping. Treatment. Autism is treated by specialists, psychologists, behavioral specialists, speech pathologists, neurologists, child psychiatrists. Keep in mind that those specializing in treating the behavioral disorder of autism tend to have little or no familiarity with the presentation of a seizure, other than the classic grand mal. There is also a tendency to attribute all behavior that occurs in a person with autism to the neurological impairment and just leave it at that without ever attempting to dissect the origin of the behavior. On the other hand, neurologists who are familiar with epilepsy may have little understanding of the behavioral syndrome of autism and the association with intellectual impairment. While attempting to understand behavior, common sense needs to be applied. It is illogical to believe that someone would just turn on a dime and begin to exhibit severe maladaptive behavior for no apparent reason. All behavior occurs for a reason. If we are upset, there is a reason. If a child has a tantrum out of the blue and it is not in response to frustration or wanting something, we must ask ourselves, what is the point of this behavior? The point is that there is no point because the behavior is not within their control. This light bulb moment led me to find another plausible explanation. If a person has a brain disorder, we need to look closer at their brain. Seizures and autism reflect a tremendous misunderstanding, which results when medical issues in a misunderstood disorder fall at the intersection between neurology and psychiatry. The intersection can be an occasion where experts meet to solve unusual problems, or it can be no man's land. It seems to be the latter. Our children with autism will never get the appropriate treatment if we do not attempt to understand their underlying problems. As concerned parents, we must ask ourselves and trust our instincts and our observations. We must ask questions. If you believe your child may suffer from a silent seizure and the psychiatrist or neurologist does not agree, make sure you explore this topic with several other physicians. Physicians who understand the silent seizure connection would be preferable. Diagnosis is difficult and complicated, because the characteristics of partial epilepsy are frequently mistaken for the behavioral abnormalities seen in autism. It is the seizures that are causing many of the odd behaviors, as well as the language deficits. What is crucial to note, and is the crux of my book, is that these seizures and the associated psychosis, if present, can be successfully treated. Loss of language can be attributed to clinical or subclinical seizures, which originate in areas of the brain that are responsible for language, such as the temporal lobe. So it is critical that these seizures be recognized as early as possible. Here are some important facts about epilepsy. 25 to 30% of people diagnosed with autism have seizures which are identifiable inside of a clinical setting by conventional methods. And those are typically the tonic-clonic type of seizure, where a person falls to the ground and has a whole body convulsion. It is believed by some experts, many others on the spectrum of autism suffer from the subclinical variety, which are the type that go undetected due to the fact that they cannot be picked up on the conventional EEG method. The risk for epilepsy increases with a greater intellectual disability and a history of regression. Epilepsy in autism increases mortality, especially in those who are on subtherapeutic levels of medication or no medication. I don't want to oversimplify how long it may take to find the exact treatment that yields the improvement and provides you with a complete answer. It took me many years to do this, and only when we had all of Josh's comorbid conditions addressed were we able to see the dramatic results. Thankfully, the daily rages that once forced me, a loving mother and devoted mother, to contemplate placing my son outside the loving home are past. We have found the right combination of medications for Josh after nearly 10 years of trying. That has been our miracle of healing. My personal experience suggests that when it comes to the accurate diagnosis of all the underlying conditions, earlier, before extensive damage is done, is far better than later. Remember that it's never too late to unlock your child's potential. At age 24, my son now is in community college with a peer assistant, pursuing his dream of attending school at his functioning level. He is non-matriculated, but finally blending in as one of the guys. For those who are silently seizing and are treated early with anti-seizure medication, I can share with the endorsement of many fine physicians that many of these children begin to show incredible gains in expressive language and comprehension, and many are beginning to speak and learn. Many will never have to experience the psychosis that often accompanies an untreated silent seizure disorder. Many will enjoy the quality of life their parents envisioned for them. This is a gift beyond measure for those children and their loving families. According to Dr. Fernando Miranda, a brilliant neurologist who runs the Bright Minds Institute in California and a major contributor to my book, tells us that many of the patients who come to him with a diagnosis of autism are actually only experiencing silent seizures. These silent seizures are causing the aberrant behavioral traits. Thus, we have seizures that are masquerading as autism. Many of Dr. Miranda's patients are getting the correct diagnosis with his cutting-edge dense array EEG, which is showing these hidden seizures. Many of his patients are attaining the dream of becoming indistinguishable from their peers. This is truly miraculous. For those who have a genetic syndrome characterized by seizures and other associated abnormalities, treating the seizures can lead to an impressive overall improvement. We are fortunate to live in a time where this information is out in the open, and it is my privilege to be able to bring it to you. I truly appreciate the opportunity I have been given to share this incredibly important information with all of you. There are so many things that I could not talk about in depth in this brief session, but I sincerely hope that what I have been able to share has offered you, and perhaps others you know, some hope for a brighter future. I believe that the additional information and tools in my book will change lives in miraculous ways. Additionally, I am available as a fee-based consultant to help guide you individually. If that is something you desire, please feel free to contact me through my website, which is silentlyseizing.com. It will be very fulfilling for me to make a positive difference in the lives of these beautiful, vulnerable people and their families. Thank you so much for coming.
Karen, thank you. I have to tell you, as the mom of a 15-year-old who's just begun puberty and suddenly now I'm seeing these seizures, this was really hard to listen to. You're describing my child. But
I've heard that so many times, Nancy.
But the good part is that your book is on its way. As soon as the publisher releases it, I have pre-ordered it, and I'm going to dive into it and hopefully turn things around for Sam.
Oh, that's terrific, and I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will turn things around, and it's a glorious time when that happens.
It really is. Hey, I want to let our participants who are using their telephone know that if you'd like to ask a question of Karen, please press *2 on your phone, and that will alert me that you have a question. We have had quite a few questions come in during the presentation. I wanted to get to a few of those here. Beth from Lewiston asks, my daughter is having symptoms of silent seizures. She is on Trileptal. She says, what medications are effective for treating these seizures? Because since listening to this webinar, she now knows that they're obviously not being treated properly by the medication. And she also wants to know, how does she approach the doctor and let them know that this is going on and it needs to be treated?
Well, that is a complex problem. Number one is that, medications work differently for different children, and it's not good to discard one medication and just leave it discarded. If one medication isn't working, you try another. We've had very good luck with Depakote, but it has to be given at a therapeutic level, and that's very important for any medication. And what I have found is that when it comes to any anticonvulsant, it has to be the brand, not generic. It has to be the brand only, because, there's just, the formulations are just not 100% when they're generic. And my son had terrible problems on the generic versions. He had tried several different medications, and Depakote was the one that really worked for him. And it's important to, keep the log, as I had mentioned, and describe the seizures, because some children have more than one type. And if that's the case, sometimes, knowing that will help guide the physician to the right medication. But it has to be, one medication change at a time, which is very important, and low and slow. You have to, go slowly and only one change. And if she brings the, log that she keeps of the behavior and why she thinks it's seizure-related, and then the evidence that subclinical seizures exist in autism, as we well know, it's very compelling. And if the doctor isn't willing to treat, I would find another doctor. I left no stone unturned until I found the right, doctors that were willing to listen to me. And the truth is, I don't even care what they call it. They don't have to, if they don't feel comfortable calling it a seizure because they can't, they can't quantify it with an EEG. Well, just give me the medications and let's see if things subside, if the symptoms subside. Because there are a lot of things we can't. Somebody comes in with a migraine, it's a very subjective complaint. There's no test for migraine, but you're going to treat it. So you have to be emphatic that you want your child treated to see if there's a remission in symptoms. And like I said, I'd be happy to, work with any families that need, somebody to hold their hand through the whole process. Because it's important and I know it's a long question, a long answer, but it's important to also understand what other conditions are a part of this. My son also has depression, because when you're chronically ill, you know, there's depression, so he needed that to be treated for that. He has a sleep disorder, he needed to be treated for that. So when all of his issues, and the psychosis, of course, needs to be treated, once everything was treated, it was unbelievable, the change in him. I mean, like so much like a typical boy now. It's amazing.
Wow. Sam is 15, so he's being treated by a biomedical doctor right now and a neurologist for the behaviors. He's on things such as gabapentin, for instance. Do you recommend, you know, stopping those medications and just addressing the seizures, or do you think it can all be done in cooperation with one another?
Well, Neurontin, you know, that's a nice adjunct type of medication. I'm a believer in monotherapy, which means one medication is preferred. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you get into, you know, two medications, it gets dicier and more difficult. And really, you shouldn't need more than one unless it's a very different, difficult, atypical type of seizure disorder that's hard to control. But for the most part, one medication can do it, and the Neurontin by itself is not a great choice. And that's from my own experience, because
right.
My son was on enough. So I believe in starting at the baseline, and
mm-hmm.
I would, you know, if it were my kid, I would get him off of that, and I would get him on something like Depakote.
Mm-hmm.
It's a delayed release, and that's another important thing. The regular Depakote didn't work as well because it wasn't extended in his system. It has to be a delayed release, and, of course, it has to be brand, and it has to be, you know, a therapeutic level. I found that 30 milligrams per kilogram of body weight is a very good barometer. For therapeutic level.
I know we're running into the same issue a lot of parents have, is that Sam cannot swallow pills. So that limits our choices as to, you know, medication delivery.
Well, I do believe that Depakote comes in sprinkles.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you have to, with Depakote and a lot of different anticonvulsants, you have to have, you know, periodic blood testing.
Right.
So, and this is very important to know also, that you always want to get the level before the morning dose, because you want a trough level. You want to make sure that the level you're getting in the morning is not a flood of, you know, the first pill that they take in the morning, because that's going to be inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
So you want it to be before they get the medication in the morning, so you can see how the delayed release is working. And that's how you know that you're in the right level, therapeutic range. And for Depakote, something like 75 to 100 offhand, you know, something like that. And for every medication, it's different. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Well, before we went on the air tonight, you and I were talking privately about the differences between, like you said in your presentation, behavioral neurologists looking just at behavior, and then the epileptologists who would be looking more at the epilepsy. I did not realize before we spoke that there was a difference, that all neurologists didn't look at everything associated with the brain.
No, in fact, I mean, I don't know about your situation, but my son was diagnosed, nobody ever looked in his brain.
Right.
And I don't think that's changed very much at all.
Mm-mm.
They watch you play in a room, your kid play, and then they give you the diagnosis. It's unbelievable. And Dr. Miranda said, who would trust such a minimal assessment? You know, it's like akin to going to an ophthalmologist and saying that you have blurry vision, and he just takes the scope and looks in your eyes and says, here, you're nearsighted. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, there's no assessment happening. I mean, language is in the brain. Why aren't we looking inside the brain is what Dr. Miranda is asking, and that's a very good question. We need to be doing that. It's a brain disorder. And the brain disorder is causing these behaviors. And such a tragic thing in my mind is when we, you know, blame a seizing person for the behavior that they're exhibiting, because we are told that they can behave better, that this is a behavioral issue, and that they need, you know, a strict, you know, ABA guidelines. And mm-hmm. shoot, this ABA has its place. My son was in an ABA program for years, but it's not a remedy alone. It's not going to help seizures. So it's part of the process of healing, but it's not the only part. And that's all we were given as my son was growing up. And I think it's doing a great disservice to children. And I also worry about those other unconventional methods that are being, you know, used. And there are aversive methods being used on poor kids. It's just horrible. So we've got to get these seizures under control. They don't want to misbehave. They have no control over it at all.
That's true.
And, the sooner we understand that, the better our lives will be.
If you would like a copy of the data controls that Karen was talking about, just go ahead and enter your email address and everything in the little box on your screen. And I'm going to be forwarding all the questions and comments to her after our presentation, so she will definitely have your information in order to forward that to you. So I just wanted to let everybody know because they're asking.
Oh, sure. Be happy to.
Sure. Paula from Poinciana, I hope I pronounced that right, asks, so when you have adequate data, who do you give this data to help you get the treatment for the seizures? And I think we kind of touched on this, but I thought you might want to elaborate a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think the perfect person would be your child's doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do this in concert with the school where your child goes. You know, you can ask for a psychologist to assist you with this functional behavior analysis. You can do your part at home. They can assist at school, and then together, you know, you could bring the information that you've both gleaned, you know, to the doctor. And the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. And if you can, you know, if you can show a consistent pattern of erratic behavior with no discernible antecedent, it's going to become apparent that there's something else going on. So that's what I would do. I would ask the school district for help so that it can be tracked in both places, home and at school.
And you touched on the correlation between migraines and seizures and how they can be mistaken for one another.
Yes.
This is kind of related, I think. Beth from Lewiston asks, my 9-year-old daughter has autism and complex partial seizures. Lately at school, she has become very lethargic, complains of headaches, and has one pupil dilated more than the other during this time. Could she be having silent seizures that cause these symptoms?
Absolutely. I would bet on it. Yes, I would get her to a neurologist. You know, just remember how important it is to note that this they don't show up on EEG all the time. Sometimes they do, very often they don't, and I would still push for treatment because those are classic symptoms.
Mm-hmm. A couple of people have asked about surgery for seizures.
Well, I mean, there are, you know, cases where they do surgery for seizures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is something I'm not an expert in that area, but I do know that certain seizures cannot be completely treated with medication. And in those instances, when they can track the seizures, you know, surgery can be very helpful in providing a cessation of the symptoms. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, certain types of seizures, like gelastic seizures.
And I'm trying to screen these questions, too, because there's no way on earth you can possibly, you know, discuss in detail someone's this medication or that medication. That's definitely something that has to go through their doctor.
Yes. I mean, I can only speak
very detailed questions here.
Well, you know, I want to remind you that I am available as a consultant if you need that, because I felt like I needed that, and there was nobody there for me. So I'm here, and if you feel you need that, you know, I will help you.
Here's one. Michelle from Fresno asks, do random fits of uncontrollable, inappropriate, almost involuntary laughter count as a silent seizure? And if so, how are they properly diagnosed?
Well, that's a very good question. And the answer is yes. Those seizures are called gelastic seizures, where you get this inappropriate laughing, and sometimes it's inappropriate crying, but it's uncontrollable, and it's out of the blue. And those can be treated with medication. Sometimes they show up, but very often frontal lobe seizures do not. And again, it's, you know, if it's subclinical, if it's not showing up, I would say to the doctor, I'd like to try a random bout of seizure medication to see if these symptoms subside. And if they do, you have your answer. You know, sometimes, I mean, if it walks like a duck and squawks like a duck, it maybe it's a duck. And the fact that we don't have a test that measures it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And that's really what you have to remember.
I have personally been hesitant to seek a specialist because I didn't want to put my son through another EEG that was inconclusive.
Right. Well,
but I didn't realize I could just say, I want to do a trial.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because we know, even, you know, Theo Adelson has been around forever, and he has talked about the subclinical seizure issue, especially as it relates to puberty, with these aberrant behaviors. And the fact that it's subclinical, meaning it just doesn't show up. It doesn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids don't get treated for their seizures, and that's why their language deteriorates in many instances, not every instance. But if seizures are contributing to the diagnosis of autism, which many, many instances they are, then you're going to have a tremendous change. And yes, absolutely, you can ask for a trial. I mean, my son was diagnosed with a mood disorder. They just think he has a mood disorder. There's no test that says, okay, you know, he's got a mood disorder. You know what I'm saying? But it's a suspected kind of thing. So if you suspect your child has seizures, it absolutely should be, they should be treated.
Huh.
Yes.
We have a question here. My child has generalized seizures. Previously had absence seizures 40% of the day, and tonic-clonic seizures once or twice a week, confirmed by an EEG. 6 months ago, all the seizures abruptly stopped. She had a 24-hour and a 48-hour EEG, both negative. Is this common, usual? Could she still be having subclinical seizures?
I don't know. That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
Usually seizure disorders don't remit like that, unless it was due to some kind of febrile illness or, you know, some kind of monumental event in the brain. But I've never heard of that stopping. So I would certainly talk to a neurologist about it.
Mm-hmm. So it's not a common occurrence that they go away just as quickly as you saw them appear.
No.
No.
Not to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. We have, let's see, my son is 5 and has just been diagnosed. A lot of questions about Tegretol.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned that Josh started on Tegretol.
Yes.
Can you tell me again why you decided that was not a good match or good fit?
He had a head-to-toe welt-like rash all over his body.
Oh, that's right. That's right, the rash. And since you were doing one... I'm sorry?
Oh, he also got that same rash from Trileptal because it's in the same family.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're very closely tied. So he couldn't take any of those, and he couldn't take Dilantin either. And that's an older medication, but a very good one. And, you know, something very interesting, when we gave it to him before we knew he was allergic to it at one point, and he said, Mom, he looked at me and he said, Mom, my brain is better. I'll never forget that.
Wow.
And then he had a febrile rash 2 days later. Yeah, so Depakote's about, you know, the only thing he can really take that works for him.
Is it a common occurrence for them to stop breathing during a seizure? Is that something that is seen common?
Yes, a tonic-clonic seizure, you can stop breathing, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, seizures can be very dangerous. That's why it's so important to control them.
See, I've had a neurologist tell me, yeah, it's probably seizures you're seeing, but that kind is not thought to be harmful to the brain.
Well, you know, it depends on what you consider harm. I mean, to me, a permanent psychotic disorder is harm,
mm-hmm.
which is what happens from long-standing untreated epilepsy. So I think they're wrong, actually.
Michelle from Fresno again just had a follow-up question. She was the one that was asking about you had said the gelastic assessment, gelastic
mm-hmm.
seizures. She
mm-hmm.
wants to know, should she see a neurologist or just a regular doctor for the assessment?
I would go to a neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to a neurologist who understands autism. I mean, if you can get to Dr. Miranda, I can't say enough about him. Even though he's, you know, he takes insurance, and I've heard that if you don't have the insurance he takes, it's expensive. But he has the sensory EEG, which nobody else has. It's cutting edge, and he's able to find these mini seizures. And, you know, some of these kids are losing their diagnosis of autism.
Mm-hmm.
He said 50% of the kids who come to him, that's pretty compelling. So if there's any way you can get to him, he's in California, the Bright Minds Institute.
Oh, okay.
In fact, if you go to his website, brightmindsinstitute.com, there's an ABC News clip, and you can click on it. He was on the, you know, ABC News, and he chronicled, you know, two families, and they're on there with him, and they both of their children were deemed autistic until they came to him, and now they're both fine. So it's something to really look at, yeah.
I also want to remind our listeners who are using their telephone that if you'd like to ask a question, just press star 2. And if you're participating with your computer, you can post your questions through the little blue box on your screen. Or I guess the background is blue, the box is gray. So just go ahead and submit your questions, and we will get to you. A lot of these are very, very specific. You said your book comes out September 5th?
Yeah.
Through the Autism Asperger's Publishing Company?
Yes, AAPC.
And mm-hmm. folks can pre-order your book if they would like?
Yes, they can.
I have.
mm-hmm.
It's just not getting here quickly enough, that's all.
Yeah. Well, I think I gave you 80% of it tonight, so.
I think you did.
So hopefully we'll get you on your way.
And your website again for folks who still have questions after we finish talking tonight is?
It's www.silentlyseizing.com. Just the way you see it on the screen, Silently Seizing. Should I spell it for everybody or?
You might want to.
Sure. Okay, silently, S-I-L-E-N-T-L-Y, and seizing is S-E-I-Z-I-N-G. Silentlyseizing.com. And, you can email me right through there. And there's a lot of information on the website, too, and links as well.
We've been told and we have witnessed stress triggering a seizure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there are many triggers. Mm-hmm. Stress is common. Flickering lights, lack of sleep, a high sugar diet. In fact, a low sugar diet is a very, very helpful thing to do. It makes a huge difference for my son. I recommend it highly. Sugar is just not good for them at all.
I have heard of people doing the low carb diet for seizure control. Have you heard
of
that?
Yes, something called the ketogenic diet. Mm-hmm. I've never gone that route, but I know a mom who has, and she was very happy with the results. And if anybody is interested in that, I can put you in touch with this wonderful mom, Arlene Martel. In fact, she has a book, Recovery Adam, and he did quite well on the ketogenic diet.
Very
so
nice.
That is something to look at, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for being with us this evening, Karen. You've really opened my eyes, and I hope that we've been able to help a lot of people around the world tonight. And I can't wait for your book to come out.
Well, thank you. Did you want to do any further questions, or...?
Well, they all seem to be quite specific, but what I will do is forward you the questions that have come in, and if you want to address any of them personally, you can do that through email, and that way we'll protect privacy here.
Okay.
Also, if any of our listeners would like a transcript of this event, they can join our Spectrum Gold Club for just $1, and they get a copy of this webinar audio and transcript, plus access to over 40 webinars that we've done so far, including Autism 101, the basics, sensory integration therapy, effective IEP strategies, and much more. Also, let us know what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. Again, that number is 877-211-0212. Again, Karen, thanks so much, and I hope we can have you back on once I've read your book.
I'd be more than happy to. I'd be thrilled.
And I'll have a whole list of my own questions, as well as everyone else's questions coming in through the website and through the phone.
Okay, great. Well, I look forward to answering them, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Have a wonderful night, everyone.
Hey, you too. Good night.
Thanks. Bye-bye.